Hello everyone, today is January 20th. Thank you.
She's okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right, we're back to studying about Hashem, and I think we're in a good place right now to start with Sefer Shmos. We turn to the beginning of Shmos. Okay. All right. God does not appear anywhere in the first two chapters. Okay, the people have to work this out themselves. And surely by the time Moshe is born, the people who are enslaved in Egypt recall some tradition about how long that slavery was supposed to last. Okay? That particular reckoning of how long that's supposed to be is extremely problematic. For one, Hashem tells Avram 400 years. In the actual story, when they leave Egypt, it says that they spent 430 years there. Mm-hmm. And so, as Rashi points out, since Levi went down to Egypt, we have a tradition that his daughter Yocheved was born just as they arrived. But Levi, who is older than Yosef, Yosef is 30, Levi is at least, you know, he's one of the older ones, he's close to 40, right? And Levi lived to be 137, right? His son Kehas lived to be 133. His son Amram lived to be 137. Right? Okay, with me on those three? Okay. So it's inconceivable that if Levi, who got to Egypt, right? He didn't get there when he was born. Okay, Kehas arrived in Egypt. Right? Kehas was born already when they got to Egypt. So from the time Kehas got to Egypt until he died, he probably gave birth to Amram sometime before he died. I mean, you don't have 400 years here, right? There's nothing in there 400 years involved, right? So that is Rashi uses that to prove a tradition that we have. Yeah, I think everybody in this room knows that amount of time that we spent. How many years there? Now, where do we get that from? There's no pasuk that says they were there for 210 years. Anyone remember how we derive this? Yes, because when Yaakov was told by God to go down to Egypt, he says, Uridu, go down to Egypt. Now, Egypt is south of Israel, but the gematria of Uridu is 210. That's how we derive this. Now, it also is very nice that from the birth of Yitzchak to the time they did go down is 190 years, right? So that's one answer that Rashi says that God told Abraham, your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, right? So
why was it important?
Egypt. Oh, we'll get that next.
Okay.
It's not just Egypt. It could be Canaan. Now I take you to a different Gemara. That's a Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, Maseches Brachos. Maseches Megillah Daf Tes tells the story of an Egyptian king named Ptolemy who commissioned the translation of the Torah into Greek. The rabbis balked at this at first, but somehow the Gemara tells us some miracle involved, but that 72 rabbis were involved in this translation, hence the Septuagint, or Targum Shivim. Whether this is the origin of that or not, I'll leave to another time. But the Greek translation of the Torah, the Gemara tells us, has its origins with this story. But the rabbis were very concerned about certain translations and stories in the Torah, and they made 18 changes. 18 changes to the text, bless you.
Thank you.
In order to avoid any misunderstanding that the Greeks might have with our text. It's an interesting shiur to go through all 18 of these and see what they have in common. One of the 18 is where it says in Shmos, and the years the Israelites spent in Egypt, 430 years. So the change that the Jews made for Ptolemy was the years they spent in Egypt and other lands was 430 years. Meaning to include, perhaps, the time they spent in Canaan. Well, it wasn't their land yet. Right? Avram didn't inherit it in his lifetime. He had to purchase land to bury Sarah. Yaakov had to purchase land. So Yitzchok was kicked around here and there. It was not our land. Right? So this is how the Septuagint goes about clearing up this 400. But that's okay for 400. Where did you get 430? Right? So that answer Rashi gives also is 400 from the birth of Yitzchak. It's 430 from Yisbenepsarim, from the time God told him this. Yitzchak was born 30 years later. Brit Ben Haftarim, chapter 15 of Bereshis, where God told Avraham,
"You'll be strange walking through
This answer, a very famous answer, Rashi gives. Tosfos discusses this answer, is not without its own problems, because if it's chapter 15 of Bereshis, if we're saying that from the time of this covenant to the time we left Egypt was another 30 years. Now let's do some simple math here. Avram was 100 when Yitzchak was born. How old must he be at the time of this covenant? 70. That's a problem. Because if Avram is 70 in chapter 15, that's a problem because Avram is 75 in chapter 12 when he comes to Israel.
Yes.
Right? Which means a very strange position. Bless you. Very strange position that the Bris Ben Haftarim is 5 years before Avram was told to go to Knas. That's very strange. Especially since chapter 15 begins, Achar ha-dvarim ha-eile ha-yadvar Hashem ha-harach. I mean, after what things? After things we don't even know about? Because it's before Lech Lecha? It's very strange. Now, it is true that Avram did go to Canaan twice, it seems, because Terach leaves in Parshas Noach. It seems they got there, went back. I'll leave that to you. I would like to suggest two other, and then move on to more germane topics of our discussion. Two other interesting, innovative solutions to the 400 and 430 problem. One is I'm going to give you as Abarbanel, and he says that in Yechezkel chapter 20, there's a long chapter of all of the terrible things the Israelites were doing in Egypt. All those midrashim, you know, about the 49 levels of tumah and the idolatry and everything else, they only kept their names, their dress, and their language, but everything else went Egyptian. Okay? You can just picture some Yiddish-speaking secular Jews eating pork sandwiches on Tisha B'Av, playing cards and going swimming. But they speak Yiddish. And they dress the same way that they did in the old country, and then it's Chaim and Yankee raising each other at the poker table. But everything else, yeah. So all of that is derived from Yechezkel Perkhof. Ravanel in that chapter says that because of the sinfulness of the Israelites in Egypt, God tacked on another 30 years. It's an interesting, innovative kind of perush. But it does, okay, what can I do? How do I know those extra 30 years? Because it says they spent 430 years there. All right? Okay. I'll give you the most innovative parish I've ever seen to this is the parish of Shmuel David Lutzato. And then we'll move on. Shmuel David Lutzato was the grandnephew of the Ramchal. He was a great scholar in the mid-19th century. And he wrote a commentary that's becoming very popular. It's being translated now into English. It's very hard to get the Hebrew one, but it's being translated now. Mm-hmm. Be it as it may, he says that he bases this on the fact that Levi only has three children, Gershon, Kehath, Merari, right? Their children are named, right? And then the next generation leaves Egypt. Okay? Three children. Each of them have children, about four or five each. And then the next generation leaves Egypt. There were 22,300 Levim leaving Egypt. How did you get to those numbers? You know what I'm saying? Yeah. I can, yeah. With all the others, I can say they're not named like that, right? So I can say that they just spread out and had so many six everywhere. But I don't know. But so Shaddal claims that they spent the full 430 years there. This is how he comes to the Cheshbon. And that the three generations of Levi are the three main generations. He thinks that there were 9 or 10 generations between the time Yaakov came to Egypt and the time they left. These are the three main generations. The years 137, 133, 137 that I just mentioned to you outline those three main generations: Kehos, Amram, Moshe. Okay. And if you add up those three numbers, 137, 133, 137, and the 17 years that they spent in Egypt until Yaakov died, right, that number is 427. And he says that it was rounded off to 430. Okay, Genug, I'm finished. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling you that a pertinent question to ask is one that a good friend Yaakov Gardetsky, now welcome back, asked us, which is why? Why, God? You want to transfer the world's center of really commerce, even changed at that time from Mesopotamia from the Fertile Crescent down south towards Canaan and Egypt. And we would like to say it's because of Avraham. Avraham moved the center of the world from Iraq, Iran to Israel, Transjordan, etc. So, like I said many times, it was a war zone and a famine zone at that time. And Avraham dutifully complies, makes his way to Canaan. And why not just stay there? Raise your children and stay. So we have to give a few philosophical answers to that. One, God tells Avraham why not. He says, "Ki lo shalem cheta emori ad heina." The Amorites who are living there now, they don't deserve to be kicked out yet. So
Avraham was deserved to be kicked out, right?
When Avraham's descendants behaved like the Amorite, they did. Now, it's interesting, just before we're coming into Israel, or we expected to come to Israel, God tells us, I'm warning you, stay away from the immoral practices of the Egyptians where you came from, and the equally immoral practices of the Canaanites where you're going to. Because, it says in the Parsha, this land will throw you up, lotoki, right? It'll vomit you. The land of Israel will not suffer that kind of evil. So he doesn't say the land of Egypt won't suffer that kind of evil, right? Egyptians are also that evil, right? But it's this land here is something special. And it will not suffer the evil of what the Amorite is doing. Yes.
But does that apply to also to the other nations? Meaning if other nations do despicable things in the land of Israel will vomit them? Or it's only for the Jewish people?
So I would tell you, from the time the Amorite left in the book of Yehoshua until 1948, and this is also a Rashi in the Torah, does it sound familiar? It says that the land would never allow anyone to succeed in building it up. And it never did. Right, you know this. I always read this Rashi in Parshas. It's in Parshas B'chukosai. Right, Rashi says Zeh Mida Tova. This Rashi's writing this in about the year 1080, and he says this land will never. These Crusaders are coming and they're going, and no one ever did. Right, very famous Harper's Bazaar. You know, Mark Twain wrote about how desolate it is. The whole place is just is a ghost town. There were lots of nations conquered it, but no one ever built it. So all right, these are esoteric things, but I'm going along with it. And I'm saying that now we can turn to some other sources that says that say that it was crucial that we should start our nationhood in this setting, strangers in a strange place, ready to accept with the Hakaras HaTov of our newly found freedom, ready to accept the Torah that we were being offered. And that, one can also say, was predicted by God to Avraham. Hashem tells Avraham, you'll be strangers, and then Avraham must feel very, very down on this. Well, really, God, why? Why do we have to start off this way? But Hashem tells him, acharechein yetzu berchush gadol. Now, we've talked about this on many occasions. What was that rechush gadol? So I tell you, it's three different things. Pshat is what Avram thought. Money. We left Egypt with money. We left Egypt with gold, with silver, with great, great wealth. Right? We also would receive a land. The land of Israel was in our pocket when we left Egypt. I'm not just telling you that to be fanciful. The land of Israel was divided amongst the people who left Egypt. Very famous Nafka Mina. Well, to whom does this make a difference? The daughters of Tzlafchad. Right? They wanted not only their father's portion, they wanted a double portion because he was a Bechor. Because they said, our father left Egypt, he never got to Israel, so what right do we have to the land of Israel? Right? We'll get married, or we'll live where our husbands live. But no, they said, if our father left Egypt, it's a sugya in Maseches Bava Basra, that the land of Israel was divided two ways, to those who left Egypt and to those who came to Israel. 40 years in between, you know. So that is Acharechein Yetzu Berchush Gadol. They left Egypt, each with a deed to a part of the land of Israel in his pocket. It says Yetzu Berchush Gadol. And the other Berchush Gadol, I think this is good pshat. Ibn Ezra even says this, that it means the Torah. I'm going to give you this great rechush that you can't buy, right? And your rechush will be you're the ones who presented this Torah to the world.
But they really could take it. You see, very the great difference. Their level upon leaving Egypt was terribly low. It's intellectual.
Okay, I agree with you 100% on this. Intellectually speaking, it was in a low place. Emotionally speaking, it was in a high place because they were emotionally very connected to God based on the miracles they had seen, based on the gratitude they felt. I agree with you on this.
And dropped him very quickly.
And then, because an intellectual connection would be that when God offered it to them, they would have done what the Goyim did when God offered them the Torah, which is to say, what?
What's in it?
What's in it? Right? You familiar with that Gemara? But God offers the Torah to the Ishmaelite and says, "What's in it?" Well, he says, "Loti, no, I can't get the Torah." Then he offered the Edomite. What's in it? Lotirtzach, I can't. He said the Moabite. What's in it? Lotinach, no, I can't. But so you should have asked us. We should have said the same. What's in it? That would be an intellectual connection. How can I take a contract without knowing what's in it? Right? Maybe we asked how much it costs, but we didn't ask what's in it. Right? But we instead, what are the two words we did say?
I'll do and I'll
Naseh v'nishma. Right? So Tosfos in Maseches Shabbos asks a question in the ninth parak. He says, "What's this? What's this agadah that you might be familiar with? It's based on Vayisyatzvu b'sachti sahar. They sat not at the foot of the mountain, but under the mountain, right? So there's this agadah that says that God had to coerce us, if you will, into receiving this divine law." By seeing this great sight of a mountain being held over their heads that would bury them right there, Shamatik Furaschem, if you don't accept the Torah. What kind of story is that? Who would need such coercion who says so freely, Na'aseh v'nishma? Right? So,
no, it's the awe itself and everything.
Correct. And the Bechor Shor says, no, the Kufiyas Har Kigigis that the Gemara talks about is an agadic expression, right, of the coercion, if you will, of all the miracles they had seen. Right? Their recent redemption from Egypt 40 days ago is what left them with no choice. They're not going to ask after all they had seen. They've already just experienced the crossing of the Red Sea. They're going to ask what's in it. Right? Those other nations didn't experience this, so they didn't ask. So we quickly... So what's interesting is that that's not an intellectual connection, though. It's an emotional connection. So that's it's interesting that the Tosefta in Baba Kama gives a list of examples of something called Gnevas Das. You familiar with this concept? Mm-hmm. Gnevas Das is giving false impressions.
Right? Like stealing your copyright or someone else's knowledge.
Yes, yeah. Cheating on a test is Gnevas Das because you're giving a false impression to your teacher that you know more than
you're
really
saying
do.
Saying that Hashem gave us a false impression with all the miracles?
No. We gave God a false impression by saying Na'aseh v'nishma.
Ah, okay.
Right? Uh-huh. One of the examples that Tosefta gives of Gnevas Das, right, giving false impressions, I think the Tosefta says, you get a guest comes to your door, an uninvited guest, and you want to show him how much you miss him, so you take him down to your wine cellar, and you open up a new barrel of wine. But you have a contract to sell 95% of it tomorrow. So he thinks you're opening up a whole new barrel for him, which is a huge expense at the time. But he thinks he owes you in return more than he really does. So that when you come to his house next time, he's going to feel he has to open up a new barrel for you. Right? So the Gemara says avoid those false examples of... Now I will tell you that if... I'm sorry for the tangent because I mention it, but a false impression does not always have to be corrected. It depends how the false impression was made. But if you'll forgive me, but saying Na'aseh v'nishma is creating a false impression. An example where you wouldn't have to correct, right, is a famous story of the Ponovitcherov back in the 60s. He had an appointment with someone here in New York for to raise money for the yeshiva in Ponovitch, and the man promised him a nice check, but he said, "I'm just leaving town today. You must meet me at 8:30 in Penn Station. I'm catching a train, and that's when it's the only place I can meet you to give you a check." And Rabbi Kahneman realized that he was unable, after he made the appointment, to make any minyan in order to make it there on time. It was at a time when minyanim weren't what they are now, I don't know, but he had to choose between davening with a minion or davening himself and making the appointment. And after much commiseration, he decided he's going to make the minion. And he's going to just run to Penn Station and see if he can find him there by the train he's supposed to take. He got there at 9 o'clock. He's looking all around. He's waiting at the number, the line to where he's, you know, the number, whatever, train number line he's supposed to go to. And after waiting 2 or 3 minutes, he sees the man huffing and huffing to get him. He says, "I'm so sorry, Kahneman. I got delayed, and I missed my train, but I'm catching the next train, and I'm so thankful that you waited for me all this time." He said he gave him a huge check afterwards, bigger than he thought, and that it helped to support the yeshiva for half a year, he said. So was he under obligation to tell him that, you know, "I'm really sorry, I came late too"? No, because the man made the false impression himself. I didn't create this false impression. All right? So anyway, I'm just putting it out there. You know, if someone asks you, "Please make a phone call for me to help me get into my child into this summer camp," and then you forget to make the call, and then 2 days later, he calls you back and says, "Rabbi, I'm giving you a shul $10,000. Thank you, the kid got in," and you never made the call. Are you supposed to say he's making his own false impression? Anyway, that's what it is. So not saying Na'aseh v'nishma is making a false impression. Why was it making a false impression? Because now, how can you make Gnevas Das to Hashem? Hashem knows what everyone's thinking. Yes, good. But the false impression is that it's making it look like I'm going to accept whatever you give me. And then 40 days later, right?
But when
Moshe is missing, and I don't know, they made him make an angel.
But they presumably meant it at the time they said it. And then they called down.
Yeah. If someone saved you.
Yeah. Here's the point. Had the connection been an intellectual connection, that would have lasted longer.
Right.
The emotional connection did not last as long. And this is what I'd like to have as the main focus of today's presentation. I'm skipping a little because it's in Parshas Shmos. I'm going to come back to the main focus of the burning bush where God appears to Moshe. And this is how I just want to connect it today. Is that God speaks to Moshe, who pushes back God 5 times. Okay, I just want to talk about the third one, where God tells Moshe, I want you to not go to Paro alone. I want you to go with an entourage. Take elders with you. And God tells him, chapter 3, look at chapter 3, verse 18. Page 138. Nope, sorry, top of 139. Tells him, take this kingdom, and this is, he says, v'shamu l'kolecha. They will listen to you. They want to listen to you. Uvasa atov v'ziknei Yisrael ha-melech Mitzrayim v'amartam elav Hashem Elokei o'ivriyim nikro aleinu v'ato nilchon noderach shlosh yosimim v'amidbar v'nizbachal Hashem Elokeinu. There are two crucial points of this pasuk. One again, I'm going to make next week. The first crucial point is that God is telling Moshe, you get that entourage with you, they will listen to you, they want to listen to you, and go to Paro and demand a 3-day vacation to offer me sacrifices. That's part of a much larger issue we will discuss in Mitzvah Shem next week. Why did God introduce this subterfuge into the story? I call it subterfuge because it absolutely looks to Paro like, all the way to the end of the story, which is amazing, that
they're coming back.
Coming back. look at the beginning of Bishalach. It says Vayishma Paro ki baracha om, and he chased after them. Right. So that's that. There are actually 3 subterfuges in the story. It borrowed things, implying, it's supposed to give him back because we're coming back, and the way God took them very precariously into a certain geographical place that really had no outlet. Right? The movie picks up on
understand
it.
That
Yul Brynner looks at where they went, and he goes, their God is not a good general. Let's catch them. Right? So you idiot, you don't realize that this is a trap?
Right.
Okay, so it's the 3 very significant subterfuges in part of the story. We'll get to them. Not to mention, by the way, hardening his heart and then punishing him for it, right? Is God acting fair? And by the way, does anybody here care? But be that as it may, I'm skipping that till next week. What I want to concentrate on for the rest of this presentation is Hashem told Moshe that if you get these Zakanim to go with you, right, that's a game changer. V'shamu l'kolecha. Right? But Moshe, listen. Ani yodati, look at the very next pasuk. Ki lo yitein eschem melech Mitzrayim l'haloch. Paro's not going to let you just go out. And I'm going to read the rest of this pasuk like Rashi. V'lo biyad chazaka means im lo biyad chazaka. Right? If I don't show him some great might, he won't let you go. Now, if you're Moshe, you're going to say, God, you're God. Just to do something extraordinary. Right? I'm saying if Moshe, the first time Moshe goes to Paro, the first thing he does is something his magicians can do. All right, Moshe's staff snake eats theirs. Okay, so you won this round little by little. But that's so what? You did something that they could do. Why don't you do something that you know they can't do, like walk out with Paro into his courtyard, point your staff at the sun, right? And slowly bring it in. The whole sky will get dark, and now you're holding the sun in your hand, and then throw it back, and let it go back in the sky. Okay, now Paro, watch, I'm going to do it again, and then now pray to your god Ra that I shouldn't do it, and let's see if he can stop me from doing that again. And then do it again. I assure you, every Israelite is going to be free the next morning. And surely every single person here can make up something right. That would have unequivocally so impressed Paro, because whatever this feeble mind can decide what God could do, God could have done. Instead, God says, no, 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 Moshe, that's not my plan. And my plan is that whatever I'm going to do to him, that by the time he lets you go, or he's not going to let you go, he's going to kick you out. That's why, you know, Charlton Heston gets it wrong on so many ways. Glenn, what does Shlachet Ami mean? I remember the Soviet Union movement was let my people go. But that's not what Shlachet Ami means. Send them out. Because that's what Charlton Heston says, let my people go. It's send my people out.
But that's the common translation.
Okay. But it's Vayibir Shalach Paro, right? Not Vayibir Shah Paro. By the time he wanted to, it's what he wants to do on his own free will. If you had pulled in the sun like that, then that would have hardened his heart or softened his heart. Then he would be sending you not with free will. Okay? So, Hashem tells Moshe, there's a glitch. Paro's not going to let you go. In other words, you're not going to have your way with Paro the way Avraham did. Right? Paro did take Sarah into the room. There was some abuse, not on her, but there was abuse because Avraham felt threatened, right? But in the end, Avraham got, you know, Sarah went unscathed. But in this particular case, you know, we're already here at the end of the line. These 400 years or 210, the years are up. It's time to go, but it's not going to be so easy, right? So then Moshe's response to this is the beginning of chapter 4. See the dollar there in the middle of the page? Okay. And it says, Vaya'an Moshe Vayomer. Vehein lo yaminu li. Right? I don't like, but they will not believe me. Vehein means, it's like vihine. Right? Vihine, meaning... Behold, God, at that point, when Paro gives us a hard time and refuses me, the people will turn on me, God. Now, according to Rashi, that's chutzpah. It's also choshed b'ksherim. Choshed b'ksherim means he's accusing the Israelites of not believing. What do you mean they won't believe you? They did believe him right away. So Rashi considers that Moshe erred in these words. And therefore Moshe was given three signs, all three of which are reminders that he misspoke and that it constitutes Lashon Hara. The snake, the forked tongue, the hand turning to leprosy, and the water turning to blood being spilled the blood of your people by slandering them. Okay? So all three signs, according to Rashi, are, we'll see in the text, they have a particular purpose, but why dafka these three signs? And to inform Moshe, you misspoke, here's your punishment. Okay? Ibn Ezra has a different approach. Ibn Ezra is great at justifying things that like the Avos Nimahos and Moshe does. And Ibn Ezra says, wait a second, there's no chutzpah here. When Hashem said they will listen to you, who was Hashem talking about?
The
elders.
Yeah.
No, the elders. He said, take the zakein, and he says, look at the top line. So he says, gather elders, they will listen to you. And Moshe says, Vahin lo yaminu li, he's talking about the masses. Okay, that's Ibn Ezra. I would like to take you now to Ramban and connect to the emotional and intellectual connection that we make. Ramban says that Moshe did not misspeak at all and spoke the absolute truth of where this story is going. Moshe says, of course, God, I know they'll listen to me. You told me. I'm not doubting anything you just said. But I tell you, V'hein, Hinei, when the Egyptians turned me down and the Egyptians refused me, they will question your ways. They're not like Avraham. I'm not like Avraham. Remember, Rashi says that in the beginning of Parshas Va'era. Moshe's not like Avraham. Right? I've said this on so many occasions here. When Moshe complains to God at the end of Parshas Shmos, right? Right? The end of what we just read this past Shabbos. Right? Why did you make this? Since I came, life is more difficult. More people are dying because they can't make up the straw. Right? So Hashem tells Moshe, you know, I told Avraham, Yitzchak is your future, and then I told him to offer him in a mountain. And he didn't ask me any questions. Come on, Moshe, you're a smart guy. Why are you hocking me here? So I what I think Moshe's doing is, because Moshe knew that this is part of God's plan. What Moshe's saying is, God, this is my problem. Because the average Israelite is not saying that the things have gotten worse before they're getting better because this is how you are working your plan. The average Israelite is saying things got worse because of my ineptitude and my inability to talk to kings, which I told you at the bush a few times. Fat Pek, Fat Loshon, Aras Fasayim, I don't know how to talk, right? I'm not against your plan or against your mission. It's just that it shouldn't be me. Surely you have lots of other Israelites who have been in Egypt all this time that you can turn to besides me. That's my hawk. Okay? So according to Ramban, he doesn't do as good a job as Rashi in explaining why Dafka, these three signs. But don't you see that all three of these signs are something that starts as A, and then it turns to B, and then back to A. Right? Mm-hmm. So Ramban says the stick to the snake, because Moshe, that's what you're going to do when you go to Paro. I want you to see. Get practice. Two, your hand. Moshe, show them. You're willing to suffer for them. Look at my hand. He showed them. He kept showing me this. See this? Now look what? Look at this. And the water to the blood, because that's going to be one of the actual plagues you're going to give them. That's going to be your first. I want to give you a little, you got to do a little driver's ed before you start driving. So it doesn't really, okay, they're quite specific. Is it as good as Rashi in explaining the connection to Lashon Hara? Okay, it's a whole different mahalach. But don't you see it's A turning to B and then turning back to A. The message to Moshe is clear, says Ramban. You started off talking to kings. You grew up in Paro's palace. You remember you were the only one with the gumption to go out there and seek your brethren's welfare and do something about it. Right? Which is part of why I chose you. And then you went and became a humble shepherd. Right? I know your internal humility, but now don't you see why you were raised in the early part of your life the way you were? Because you can go back to that and talk to kings again. You get it? Mm-hmm. You were A, you turned to B, now you turn back to A. Oh. This is how God is working. And the purpose of the signs, Hashem tells Moshe, this is how chapter 4 goes, is that, I agree with you, Moshe, you know, you're a smart guy, they will turn on you when things get worse. Right? They'll listen to you, they will believe you, and they will turn on you when Paro doesn't. It's part of my plan too. What should you do at that point?
Keep the faith.
What? Show them these signs. Show them that someone sent you. Because when Paro turns on you, they will say, you must be a phony. Because if you were real and God really did speak to you, Paro would not be able to stand up to you this way. Tell them that this is part of my plan, that I really did speak to you, And proof of that are these miracles that you're doing. Okay? It sounds very good and plausible, right? Why didn't that work? Let's see. Chapter 4, Moshe finally does go to them after quite a bit of excitement and setbacks here and there. He leaves with his family, but somehow he never makes it to Egypt with his family. How do we know that? Parshas Yisro, when he after the whole story is over, he sees his wife and two kids, not one, but two, are with his father-in-law. Right? Only one's been named, Gershom. And then we find there's a second child, that's probably the child with the bris. Right? Okay. I'm not going to do that right now, but we'll have to finish our topic here. And if you look at, in page 142, V'yemar Hashem el Aharon lech likras Moshe HaMikbara. It seems that God told Aharon this before he appeared to Moshe at the burning bush. You got this? God appeared to Aharon before because he's...
Because it's a distance.
Yeah, otherwise he's going to start now. Aharon, I just spoke to your brother yesterday. Go out now. That's going to be a few weeks. No, Aharon is already nearby. Okay? And he met him at this place, at the burning bush, where he's... Right? So Moshe told and probably showed Aharon all of these three signs. This Vayelech Moshe Aharon is a nice introduction. This happens a lot in Shmos when Moshe and Aharon, who are a plural subject, get a singular verb. It should be Vayelchu.
Right? Right.
So Vayelech is that it often happens with the two of them. Mm-hmm. This is not always true. For instance, Vayikach Shem Vayefes Es HaSimla Vayichasu Es Ervas Avihen. Vayikach Shem Vayefes. It should see Vayikchu. And Yefes is older than Shem. 2 years older. Right? So why does it say Vayikach? So there, Rashi could have said, like he says by Moshe and Aharon, they acted as one, they were partners. No. Rashi says that Shem was the one who advised to do it. Yefet didn't just came along to help. Why? Because when Noach wakes up from his drunken stupor, he blesses the daylights out of Shem, and Yefet is just like a drag along. Yafter Shem Yefet, V'yishkom be'ol Shem. Why? Bless them equally. Okay, you know, in all fairness, this is a Torah being given to Shem's descendants, not to Yefet's descendants. But in all fairness, you know, so the singular verb with the plural subject sometimes can teach really only one of them is acting, like in the case of Eikach Shem V'Yefes, or that they're acting in concert, like all these singular subject verbs and plural subjects for Moshe and Aharon. Okay, so it says, "Vayidaber Aaron is called him Hashem Diber Hashem al Moshe." Aaron was the spokesman, as is part of the discussion at the burning bush. Vayas haosos leinei haom, vayamein haom, vayishmehu ki pakad Hashem es bnei Yisrael v'kiruas on yom v'iktu mishtachar. Tell me, what's the problem?
He
did the signs too quickly. He showed them the signs immediately. Vayamein ha'am. Don't you get it? This is exactly the problem that happened with Bnei Yisrael. If I wanted to convince you that this great promise that you had been taught about a patriarch from hundreds of years ago was told about your own plight, and now that's gloriously coming to an end. And I'm going to make an intellectual connection to you. Why did God make this happen? Give this shear to people to spread out, right? Okay, make an intellectual connection. The people that'll last longer. Instead, right? Instead, what did Moshe do? Moshe, it seems like it's Aaron. He showed the miracles immediately. And then this is Vayamin Ha'am. It seems that, I mean, right afterwards, Vayasis Osos, Vayamin Ha'am. As if though the basis of the what God told them, they will listen to you, they'll believe you, the basis of their acceptance was the miracles they had seen. Sort of like the basis of why we said Nasa v'Nishma, which is weak. Which is weak. Which is broken. Which can be broken quickly. Right? There's a Medrash should ask, why didn't Paro just kill Moshe? That makes the movie also, where someone says, at the point of this sword and this blasphemer, you know, speaking about turning the water to blood. And Paro says, no, you'll make a martyr out of him. Right? So the people have bought in, right? But they have bought in emotionally. So that when Paro turns on them, right? And then the people turn on Moshe, right? Paro's strategy is not to kill him. That'll make a martyr out of him. Let me make their lives miserable because of him, and they'll hate him. Let me sow strife between them. Right? Turn one of them against the other. That's the best way for me to deal with him. And it works with Bnei Yisrael. And at that point, Moshe can say, no, God told me this would happen. He goes, and he said, let me show you. I have some signs to show you. He goes, Moshe, you played that card already. Right? You've seen that already. And I'm saying, in other words, they will believe you without all of that. You don't need to show them that for them to believe you. Hit them on an intellectual basis. And then, when their intellectual acceptance is weakened, then touch them emotionally. But if the foundation is emotional and it's only emotional, then it's weak. It can break. Right? I've always said the Rambam wrote 14 books of his Mishneh Torah. What's the name of the first one? Mada, Hilchos Yisrael HaTorah, Hilchos Tshuva, Hilchos Avodah Zarah, Hilchos...
Mada
and Ahava. Ahava is the second one. Okay. Mada is intellect. Ahava is love. So Ahava is the laws of Tzitzis, Tefillin, Davening, Bracha, is, you know. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Deos is part of, you know, part of Mada. So, first, the Rambam says you have to hone the intellect. Then you could be on the level to make gain. This is why you could say people fall in love at first sight. No such thing. There's no such thing. A person says, oh, hello, I love you. Won't you tell me your name? Remember that song? No such thing, right? That's infatuation. There's something called infatuation at first sight. That's no doubt. You think that's love. It's not. Right?
Would you put Rachel and Yaakov in that as infatuation knowingness?
Yeah, the moment he meets her, he finds out that this is the daughter of Lavan, and that since I know that she is sort of set aside, as my mother said, for me to marry, so it also raises it to a different level. She was a total stranger. But since you raised that, I think it's definitely appropriate, just let me see how much time remains, if I can, just in a few minutes, where the generation before that, where Avraham sends someone to find a wife for Yitzchak, and he makes a whole elaborate plan over how to choose someone, right? And after the plan, it says inexplicably in the text, he ran straight to Rivka and asked her, do you have water for me? And then she gave him water, and then only after he finished drinking, then she said, can I give you camels? Which is a little different than what he said. She was supposed to say, I have for you and your camels, but she did better. I'm not going to say, I have for you camels until the humans finish drinking. Right? So, the Rashi asks the question, why did he run straight to Rivka? Why didn't he give any other girls there a chance? There are 40 girls there, 60, 100 girls. Just call out, who has water for a thirsty stranger? And let everybody get up there and get a chance. How is he so sure to be one for one? The one girl he runs to first. Oh, Rivka, beautiful. Was she wearing a sign? I do good. Why did he run to her? Famous Rashi.
He saw the water
rising out of the well into her pail.
Do we know that if there were any other girls there?
It says the Bnos Ha'aretz Shoavos Mayim. And all the daughters of that area were doing that there. So why does he just run to her? So where did Rashi get that? It's not because, you can't say because he ran to her. Why else did he run to her? That's circular reasoning. It's because the other girls, it says, they were Shoavos Mayim, Shin Aleph Bet, which is to put a pail with something heavy in it so when it hits the water it doesn't just float there, it sinks into the water. Right? And then when the water breaks the plane of the top of the pail and it fills the pail, you roll it up. That's called Shoav Mayim. When she gets the water, it just says V'tamaleis Kado. Because why? She doesn't have to Shin Aleph Bet like the other girls. All right? That's how Rashi works. Okay? So when he sees the water going into it, he runs right after him, and he's running with the, taking the rings out of his hand and the bracelets out of his hand while he's running to her, because that's it, she's the one. But then he catches himself because he was emotionally connected to saying this is the perfect girl for Yitzchok, she's Melumedes Benissim, right? Just like Bnei Yisrael were because of the mountain, the figurative mountain over their head, and Bnei Yisrael watching these three miracles that Aaron and Moshe are prematurely showing them, right? So he caught himself. He caught himself because he says, "I do not want the basis of my choice for Yitzchak to be just something emotional. It must be intellectual. I must intellectualize the connection by making sure she's a balas chesed, that she's willing to go through this great effort to, because camels drink an awful lot, and to see if she has that nida." And the text draws a lot of connections between Rivka and Avraham. Vayimaher, vatzmaher, vayorotz, vatorotz, the way Avraham runs for strangers. There it's more than just water, you know, it's a whole bunch of things. It's shade and water, you know, things that we needed for the sukkah. Well, Chazal loved to make the connection. What Avraham did himself for everybody, God himself does for us in the desert. The one thing Avraham got for someone else, from said, let it be taken for you, was the water. So Hashem said, no, the water I'm going to get a messenger. You get it from a rock. Right? Had Avraham gotten the water himself, Moshe would have made his way into Israel. There would have been no rock story, right? All right, but anyway, so that's how Vida Kenegad Mida works. But the point is, because Avram said, let water be brought for you. So God didn't give us the water, the bread. Avram gave bread directly. The bread comes from God, from the heavens. Avram gave the shade, so God gave us the sukkah, the protection. But Avram said, let water be brought for you. So the water came through a messenger, not straight from God. Okay, but you see that there's a connection how she's behaving very much like Avraham in that story, and so that's the same thing here, is that he didn't want to make a singularly emotional connection. He made the intellectual connection by putting her through this test of the water for the camels, in order to solidify the relationship, and that's.
But Avraham and his Eved, they were intellectuals compared to the Israelis after the slavery.
And economy.
They were nobodies.
It could be that they were incapable of making a fully intellectual
already.
Connection. But to say that it was the point is that the emotional connection they made was to the exclusion of the intellectual connection. That's what led to the ego. Yes.
But do we really know that this was the real test? Because, you know, Eliezer also had a single, I think, daughter that he wanted Yitzhak to marry her, right?
Yes.
So could it be that, you know, this whole thing was like some, I want to say, weird test that he came up with, because really he still had maybe hidden motives?
That's certainly Midrashim discuss and this Mahalach does not necessarily have to answer for that Medrash. Why Rashi does mention it, right? So he may have thought, let me give her this very difficult test and come back home and say, Avram, I'm sorry, I worked it out with God. You said he would send an angel before me. So I made a deal, and nothing happened. No one did it. Mm. Right? If no one at all gave him water, then maybe he would. It was an academic question, of course, but maybe he would have come up with some other plan. I don't know. Anyway, I think we have to go on Dav Marv. Yep. So next week I'm going back to the beginning of the burning bush story, and we'll see some other, especially why God appears to Moshe in a burning bush at all. Why a bush, a burning bush? Well, you know, there are all kinds of interesting images here.
Wow.
Okay, Marv upstairs.